Fan, Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Anderson, Stephen Brunt, and who had Mike Smith winning the goaltending matchup against Jacob Markstrom in this Battle of Alberta?
It didn't, yes. With, I mean, with one small exception.
The bad goals have been bad.
Yeah, really bad.
Markstrom has an .850 save percentage through the first four games of this series. It's been very difficult to stop that top line of the Edmonton Oilers, and they need to do it tonight or they will be going home. Let's talk to Eric Francis, Sportsnet's Flames columnist. How's it going, Eric?
I'm great. How are you guys? You enjoying this series so far?
No, it's been amazing. It's been remarkable. Yeah. I don't know what tonight has in store for us, but it's seemingly a new narrative every single game. So I mentioned Markstrom, Eric. How much of the blame do you think he should be shouldering? Because I think Connor McDavid's quite good. Evander Kane, quite good. Leon Draisaitl, a little banged up, but also quite good. I mean, how much of this just is goaltending?
Yeah, it's played a role. I mean, I think that his worst game, to be honest, was the opening game, which they actually won. That was the only game where I look and say, those were bad goals. And there were only two of them. You know, I've kind of looked at all the goals. And, yeah, the opening goal, 21 seconds into game four, kind of a crucial time to just cough up the puck and hand them a 1-0 lead. That was a bad goal, too. But at the end of the day, it's kind of an interesting scenario because Markstrom's been brutal against the Oilers all year long. His numbers, as you guys know, I mean, he's a Vezina Trophy finalist. He's one of the top three goaltenders in the National Hockey League. I don't think many people dispute that. But against the Oilers this year, if you break out the numbers, regular season and playoffs, his goals against average is over five. That's not NHL caliber yet. That's where they are, and that's why they're down 3-1.
So, Eric, I know the mood of the town a little bit because I'm on with your comrades on the morning show twice a week. So I do kind of know what the pulse is in Calgary right now. But what, any sense of the mood around the team? You know, it's coming off that first series that, you know, they had to play it airtight and it was really tense but a triumph in the end. And then this one has been all over the place, but, including that last game, coming home with an elimination game on your plate, I don't think they anticipated that heading into this one. Like what's the confidence level like? The feeling about that, getting that first line going? I love the coach and he seemed, you know, not, I don't want to say pleased after the last game, but he seemed very confident, Darryl did, after the last game. Like what, how would you assess it?
I would say that the coach, a lot of the players, and I think people in the city are very confident and optimistic that they're going to win tonight. Like, and I share that view. I really don't think that tonight's going to be the problem. The problem is trying to win three in a row against the best player in the world with a pretty good supporting cast right now because he's elevated all their games. Do I think the Calgary Flames can win this series? No, I don't. Do I think they'll win tonight? Yeah, I absolutely do. And you mentioned Daryl Sutter. I thought that's interesting because I agree with it. Daryl's the king of everything that he does in those legendary press conferences of his where he treats us all in the media like pinatas and pawns in his little game. You know, his message right after game four, he almost was smiling after that loss. Mm-hmm. And I think it was all about just trying to say, hey, we're fine. You know, we got this. We can be better. We know we can be better. We played a pretty good game. We could have easily won this. We lost it. And now we'll go home and we'll be better. So I think it was all about posturing and trying to put on an air of confidence. But I think people are buying it. Like, I think, you know, this team is a lot better than it's shown in this entire series. It still hasn't played a very good game in this series yet. And I think people are confident that it'll come tonight. And as for the mood in the city, you know, if this was first round, and I know you guys in Toronto can relate, like, that fear of thudding, you know, the season ending with a thud in the first round is just a terrifying, awful, gut-wrenching feeling that many cities have. You guys know it well. Calgary's known it well forever. They got over a bit of a hump by winning that game 7 in the first series. So I don't think it's fear and dread that they're going into tonight's game with. I think, they're scared and they don't want this to end because it's been a whole lot of fun for the province. But I don't sense everybody's terrified to go and watch this game tonight.
Yeah, but it's Edmonton. Like, yeah, you got through the first round, but if you, yeah. you lose to Edmonton in the second round, everybody say, "Oh, that's okay. Oh, we won a round this year. It's fine."
No,
it's got to be terrible.
No, Stephen, you know that people in Alberta don't just say, "Oh, well, we lost the Battle of Alberta. We'll get them next year. It doesn't work that way.
No.
We've had to wait 31 years for this Battle of Alberta. No, people will not be happy with the fact that the inferior team, and, you know, I think it's pretty clear during the season they were the inferior team. You know, the favorite team, the Flames, you know, if they lose in five, that's pretty good gut punch. Don't get me wrong. But it's not the same fear that people had in that first round when it looked like they may lose to Dallas.
Yeah, they got through that because they played that lockdown playoff style of hockey that we thought would bode them well into this series. And yeah, game one was, I guess, a harbinger of things to come in this series because it has not been that. I mean, I think a large portion of that is, yeah, playing against the best player on planet Earth. But is there any hope of getting back to that style of hockey that had people picking them to go deep in the postseason?
Well, it's so funny because both teams went into this series saying that they wanted to play that lockdown, airtight 2-1 hockey. I call BS when the Oilers were saying they wanted that. But, you know, that's what over the last couple of months, Jay Woodcroft's done a really good job trying to get them to play that style of hockey because the universal belief, I think, in hockey and pro sports is defense wins championships, and you got to learn to play D. The Oilers have been guilty of not learning how to play D in the past, and it's cost them. And now they claim that they know how to play it. They're doing a pretty good job against the Calgary Flames, no doubt, but I never thought that we would see a 1-0 or a 2-1 game in this series. And clearly, we haven't even come close to seeing anything like that. So whether either coach likes it or not, it's a lot more wide open. There's a lot more offensive talent than anybody could suggest would be shut down over the course of 60 minutes.
How much heat is there on the first line in Calgary right now, Eric?
Huge. Yeah. Not big. And it's what's interesting, Stephen, is, you know, Johnny Gaudreau is an unrestricted free agent this summer, right? I mean, and that's, you know, I think people are dreading, you know, if Johnny Gaudreau and Matthew Tkachuk and Elias Lindholm, and statistically they were by far the best line in hockey this year. And I know people in Toronto saying, say what? But just if anyone checks out the stats, it's not even close. Those guys were all plus 57, plus 61, and it was ridiculous. So they can play defense, too, on that top line. And yet here they are, you know, really, really faltering. I looked at the numbers this morning. The Oilers' top line has 30 points in four games. I mean, guys, just think of those numbers. And the Flames' first line has 13 points. You're not going to win many series if that's the case with the top two lines going head-to-head. And most of those 13 points for the Flames' top line came in that opening 9-6 win. So, yeah, a lot of this will be on Johnny when people dissect how this season went. And that really does set up a very interesting summer as he decides whether or not he wants to come back to Calgary or seek greener pastures. And it's just going to be a fascinating fascinating summer for that because he scored that iconic goal that won them the Game 7 against Dallas, and that got the city over a huge hump. You wonder if that might keep him here and he might want to stay? I have my doubts. I've always believed he's gone after this season. Mm.
What are the Oilers doing to them that almost nobody else could do this year?
It's possession. It's all about possession. The Calgary Flames, you look at all these possession stats around the league, and I'm not a big analytics guy, but, you know, I do look at these. And the Calgary Flames were a juggernaut this year because they had the puck for the most part. Darryl Sutter hates when you use the term defense, you know, that they're a defensive team. He doesn't buy that. We're not a defensive team, he always says. He says we're a possession team. We're a team that goes in, and the reason why people don't score on us very often is because we have the puck in their zone all the time. So it's all about forechecking, and it's all about possessing the puck. And the Calgary Flames have not been able to establish a forecheck. They've not been able to retrieve pucks or get into the Edmonton zone and hold the puck. So that's what it all boils down to. The Calgary Flames are, offensively they've faltered, and that's hurt them defensively. And hey, the departure of Chris Tanev is their best defenseman. That's also been a big role in this whole thing. When he came back last game, that was the Flames' best game in the series so far, and I don't think it's a coincidence that Chris Tanev was back, but anyone who watched that game saw how much pain he's in with every single shift.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, he's writhing out there. I also think a big part of what's happened to the Flames is Connor McDavid. I know he was silent with just his two-point night in game four, but I mean, it's been unbelievable here, Eric, and I know he's a two-time Hart Trophy winner and what, four-time Art Ross winner. But what is this postseason run, and especially if he's able to get through the Flames and get to a Western Conference final? Like, what is this run doing for the all-around legend of Connor McDavid?
Oh, it's taking it to a new level. Like, Ben, it's amazing. You know, it's funny you asked what's the difference in this series, and I would have probably said 2 games ago or even just 1 game ago, I would have said Connor McDavid. But it's funny that people in Edmonton take great offense to you suggesting this is just Connor McDavid. And when you look at the numbers around him, you know, Mike Smith's having great numbers, got good numbers. And you look at what Evander Kane's doing and Draisaitl. Draisaitl has 13 points in 4 games. He has more points than McDavid in this series. But the point is, Kane doesn't have 12 goals in 11 games if he's not playing with Connor McDavid. Leon Draisaitl, who probably is the second-best player in the world right now, I don't know if he'd still have 22 points or whatever he has in the playoffs so far. But Connor McDavid is the straw that stirs that drink. And you talk to guys like Mark Spector, you talk to guys like Jim Matheson, all the guys who have covered the Oilers for a long time, they'll tell you that what Connor McDavid is doing right now is next level. They haven't seen this from him to this degree so far. So he's turned it up to a whole new level. And you guys know with some of the stats he's throwing up there, he's in Gretzky territory.
Yep.
He's in Mario Lemieux territory. He's doing things that, you know, in one case there, Gretzky never even did. He's got more multiple point games in the first 11 or 12, whatever it is. I can't even keep up anymore with the stats. But you're right. They neutralized Connor McDavid the other night, and he had 2 assists. That pretty much sums up the series. It really does.
Yeah. Can't wait to see Austin Matthews sheepishly go up to collect his Hart trophy this year. That'll be fun.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. Like, we look now in the postseason and say, yeah, you know what? We probably realize now we all should have voted for Connor McDavid. I voted for Austin Matthews to win the Hart. And so I don't think it's – he earned it. But what we're seeing in the playoffs kind of reminds everybody that maybe we shouldn't vote for the Hart until after the playoffs are over.
No, it's a regular season award. But, yeah, Connor McDavid was also awesome during the regular season, setting career highs. So, whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah, I can't wait to watch tonight. Eric, thanks for this.
Guys, anytime. Enjoy it. I hope it keeps going because it's just fun, isn't it? I don't care who wins or loses. It's just great for hockey. And I'm so glad. Don't take this the wrong way. I'm not saying I'm glad the Leafs are out, but I'm so glad that this series has the national spotlight on it, and you guys are treating it that way, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, that's a roundabout way of saying, yeah, I'm glad the Leafs are out. But, yeah, no, we get it.
Read it the way you want.
See you, Eric.
See you.
Take care, boys.
There's Eric Francis, Sportsnet Flames columnist. Yeah, Connor McDavid never going to have to answer any postseason questions again.
No.
Like, if he doesn't win a cup, that'll be the thing, right, hanging over his head. But it's a different world than what Austin Matthews and the Toronto Maple Leafs have to deal with now until they win a postseason series.
Yeah, no, it helps to win a series. Although Eric's the thought that Calgary, that having won and getting that monkey off their back barely against Dallas, we're going to feel any kind of relief if they get rolled by the Oilers, finish the job here. Nah, it's not going to be like that at all.
That sounded like keep telling yourself that that's how it's going to feel.
They don't like, I know everybody else, every other hockey fan pretty much on earth is going to be, if Connor McDavid rolls into the conference finals here, is going to be talking about, is this a great thing to watch? A generational player. We're all lucky to have seen him in our lifetime. And well, let's just sit back and enjoy it. Not in Calgary. No chance.
No.
No, they don't like the Connor McDavid chat that much in Calgary, in my experience.
Yeah, I'll bet. And I mean, yeah.
They like it better than the Austin Matthews chat, maybe, but not really. No. Now, the other thing is last night, because I kind of was thinking, well, here the Oilers are going to, and I think Eric's right, it's going to be tough sledding for the Flames to win 3 in a row in this series, even if they win tonight. But then you kind of thought, well, then they're going to run into Colorado, and they're the best team in the league, essentially, this year. And that, well, but that was that finish last night.
Yeah,
man. Oh man. Like to see, and this, you got to kind of separate the Nathan McKinnon goal and say, that's one of the greatest goals I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Period. And to put them ahead, but that was against the flow of play at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Right. St. Louis had come back and tied that game, and Colorado was in full retreat. Like, they looked scared to, you know, like, scared is the wrong word, but you know what I mean? Kind of just like, please don't score on us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are real, and I know I have to throw the Leafs into every conversation.
Sure.
But they're
good. They are a good reference point.
Okay. But yeah, it's a negative reference point, obviously.
Yes.
So the Avalanche have won rounds. They won a round this year.
Mm.
But there are legitimate playoff bugaboos for this team that has been expected to do the greatest thing in the postseason and win a Stanley Cup. They've been at that level for a couple of years now and have yet to make it to a conference final, right? They bowed out in six games to that Vegas team that we saw had its warts a season ago. To blow this lead against a team without its starting goaltender, its Stanley Cup champion goaltender, after having a 3-0 lead in an elimination game, like
on home ice, you're closing it out. It's routine.
Yeah, you're only human if you allow the ghosts of postseason past to just start creeping into your head at that point.
But those goals, all of those goals at the end, including the, it was, you could just see that Colorado retreating now, you know, retreating in their own end and playing scared, like playing kitty bar the door, right? You can't, that's not the way that team should be closing out an elimination game on home ice when they go into the third period with a lead.
You know who didn't do that?
Who?
The Toronto Maple Leafs. They played on their front foot, even down in game six and coming all the way back. And
they did.
Yeah, it was against the run of play that the Lightning scored in overtime
in game six
to extend
That's
it.
That's all
to a
true.
They still lost. Yeah.
And Colorado could still, you know, may well still win this series. But I thought that they just looked flawed there last night in a way that I didn't expect them to. And then, you know, then the MacKinnon thing happened and you go, well, yeah, they were, you know, playing scared and playing backwards. And then suddenly a world-class player makes an unbelievable world-class play. And it just takes your breath away, and the St. Louis surely will just surrender now because they know it's futile. No.
No, they didn't.
No, and they looked, you know what St. Louis looked like? They looked like a team that had won a Stanley Cup.
Yeah. Yeah, they absolutely did, and they score on the 6-on-5, and then they score in overtime.
Yeah, and were just relentless.
Yeah.
And you know, the kind of the panic in front of the in Colorado net, and a lot of guys standing around and watching with loose pucks, like, you can't do that. You can't play like that.
Yeah, I hope they don't continue to play that way because I would really like to see Nathan MacKinnon against Connor McDavid.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I do, and I don't want to see St. Louis in that series. You know, especially after the Craig Berube stuff. I don't want to see, I've got an anti-rooting interest now. So, yes, I want to see the Colorado, you know, Colorado-Calgary would be fine too. Mm-hmm. But Colorado-Edmonton would be, as neutral, that's what you want to see. But, boy, I had grave doubts about them after watching the finish of that game last night.
Yeah, again, it looked familiar to people who have seen this Leafs team in postseasons past. Not this year, because they played on their front foot. But yeah, in postseasons past, the ghosts of previous postseasons creeping into their heads. It looked very much like that Avalanche team yesterday. So I mentioned Blue Jays starting this four-game series against the Angels tonight, going into Anaheim. The top two finishers in the American League MVP award race a season ago facing off. Second time in their careers that they've faced off. I think Vlad's career 1-for-2 with a walk against Shohei Ohtani. I wonder, and Vlad's starting to do more media. I don't know. We've been privy to a little bit of his thinking around individual awards and motivation. Like, he hasn't totally sloughed off the MVP stuff as in, you know, it's an individual award, I'm all about this team. Like, you can do both, right?
Yes.
Because the team performs better if you perform better as an individual. And he has said that he felt a little slighted that he didn't get even a single first place vote for MVP last season, even though he admitted that, you know, Shohei Ohtani's season deserved the American League MVP. I wonder if there's anything to that motivational stuff, because I know we talked about Josh Donaldson the other day. Josh Donaldson, at the end of the 2015 season, went into Anaheim and took the MVP award from Mike Trout, right?
Yeah.
That was a conversation, and you know what? By numbers, Mike Trout might have deserved that MVP award, but we all watched that series where he just, like, single-handedly felt like he knew the narrative was on the line, and he just destroyed the Angels in those three games. It's such a different sport that I don't know if you can get motivated, especially in hitting. Like, you try harder seems like a bad idea.
It's a bad idea, I think.
But it worked for Donaldson, though.
Well, I think some guys thrive on the stage, whatever the stage is. They thrive on attention. It's such an individual sport. And we talked about this a lot, right? It's not like other team sports. It's a sport of individual actions that add up to a team. It's not you're not all pulling the oars together. It doesn't work that way in baseball. And trying hard generally doesn't, because yeah, you can't try your way. If Vladdy could try his way into hitting, yeah, he'd be hitting better right now. I think he's trying plenty hard. And I think guys who are way less talented than him try hard too. I'm not sure there's kind of a way you can work yourself into being a great ball player. Mm-hmm. You know, you can, yeah, probably obviously practice matters and being smart matters and understanding the game and a lot of that stuff. But it's fine motor skills, right? It's not emotional. It's not an emotional game by and large. There are emotional moments, but I think if you kind of get out of your zone and your heart starts beating too fast, it's like being an emotional golfer. Like, that would be bad, wouldn't it?
Yeah, no, for sure. And I am one. The emotion is anger. But Vlad has a sense of the moment, though, as well, right?
He seems to, for sure.
I had the three-homer game in the Bronx where, yes. I mean, at that moment, it was a legitimate conversation to say, is this guy the best hitter in the sport right now?
Yes, it did. Yep, and I think you're right. That was the big stage, and that was TV all around America and all of that stuff.
Well, we have MLB Network on in the studio right now. Guess what's the marquee game tonight?
Mm-hmm.
It's the top two American League MVP vote getters from a season ago, locking horns. Now it's a later game.
So they also, by the way, just did a feature on what's wrong with Vlad. So that's a conversation in baseball right now, because it was back when he had that 14 game singles hitting streak.
Yeah,
people weren't saying that; they were saying, "Don't worry, he's going to be fine." But now the conversation has shifted.
Honestly, that Mike Petrello article on MLB.com, I implore people to check it out. Well, I mean, not if you
want to be happy.
but if you want the truth, truth should be more important than happiness.
It will not set you free. I'm sorry if that truth.
Yeah. No, I mean, the major takeaway is that, okay, so it's good. Vlad has not been striking out during the month of May, and he's taken his occasional walks. And guess he's also hitting the ball hard.
Yes.
But on the ground.
Yes.
Explicitly.
Yes.
Because seemingly Major League Baseball teams have figured out the formula, and it's not a mind bender. It's this guy hit a lot of home runs on fastballs at the top of the zone a season ago, like almost 30 of them. And they're throwing him perilously few fastballs, and the ones they are throwing are a zillion miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that they are throwing at a zillion miles an hour at the bottom of the zone, where all he seemingly is able to do is just put the ball on the ground.
And which is also why he was chasing. He's chasing less now, but he was chasing because those pitches that he wanted were not available to him.
Right.
Yeah. It's a bad combination.
Mm-hmm.
And, look, there's every possibility. He's rather young still. And I think he's extraordinarily talented, which is not, the hottest take in the world. But this pitching is really good right now.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody throws hard. And there's not a lot of soft touches. Even bad teams have good pitchers. We just, like Cincinnati's not as bad a team as we just saw, as their record might suggest, because they do have some live arms there.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, there's a lot of guys throwing really, really hard right now and throwing really well. He's going to have to, we can talk about all the other stuff, like protection in the lineup and all those things. This isn't about the guy hitting behind you. If they, if they've identified a way to attack you, they're just going to attack you like that. It doesn't matter who's hitting behind you.
No, it's 100%. Yeah, it's adjustments, and then you make the adjustment, and they adjust to your adjustments. Well, we'll see if he can make the adjustment tonight against one of the game's greats and as good a hitter as Shohei Ohtani might be. Joe Maddon has talked about this. He's more valuable to that team as a pitcher right now. And, yeah, he's kind of, his batting stats are pretty similar to Vlad's right now, except every fifth day he steps on the mound and throws 100 miles an hour.
Yeah, so that, I don't think Vlad's going to do that anytime soon. But I'm not going to say this is a pivotal series or any of those things. But,
oh, it's not?
But, you'd kind of, and I'm not crazy about the pitching matchup tonight, although you never know. Some days, it may be that you'll get the best of him. And the bullpen should be well rested unless they went out and partied on their off day. But this is one where when you look at the kind of the schedule and step back, you say, well, this is a better Angels team, it appears, than we've seen. It's not the usual underachieving Angels team. They've got more pitching than they've had. And you want to go in there and get two of the four.
Mm-hmm.
And then come home and start taking care of business.
Yeah. No, and you know what? You look around baseball, those teams that struggled early on with the bats, including the Boston Red Sox, and Anthony Kastrovitz alluded to this, that we're not having the same conversation about the league-wide batting average being .210 anymore, right? No. Mm-hmm. The weather's heating up, and so are the bats, and about time for the Blue Jays bats to do the same. When we come back, we'll get back into this Canada soccer story as their friendly against Iran on June 5th has been canceled. We'll talk to Peter Galindo, Sportsnet soccer writer, next as the Fan Drive Time continues. Ben Ennis, Stephen Braun, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Fan Drive Time, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Ben Ennis and Stephen Brunton. We're getting back into that top story brought to you by Thornhill Toyota. If you had plans to attend the soccer friendly between Canada and Iran in Vancouver on June 5th, you need to make alternate plans.
Well, there may be a match with, if they can find somebody.
Yeah.
There may be somebody else on the pitch opposite Canada. We're just not sure.
Not North Korea, though, right?
Do you think that's the fallback?
I hope not. I don't know. What a mess. All right, to help us sort through it, let's bring in Peter Galindo, a Sportsnet soccer writer. How's it going, Peter?
Going well, guys. Thanks for having me back on the show. And yes, what a mess indeed.
Honestly, and I was really enjoying reading through your tweets and listening to some of your podcast appearances today, Peter. Like, what is the immediate fallout of this? Like, where was your brain going immediately when you saw this news?
Well, first of all, really when it was first announced and even when there were rumblings of Iran being the friendly opponent, there was a sense of discomfort from me. But I figured, look, as long as Iran accepts and visas are approved, then maybe things will be relatively okay. But then as I started to hear that there was a little more pressure being put on the Canadian Soccer Association day by day, the thought immediately went to what will be the financial ramifications more so, because the whole reason they're in this situation to begin with is Iran was not their first choice for a friendly opponent. I think most people can understand that. The big deterrent for other countries accepting Canada's invites was purely financial. They just wanted too big of a cut from ticket sales, for appearance fees, what have you. And that is largely why they didn't get a bigger dog in this window, coupled with the fact that European teams are just off the table due to their Nations League games. So that's what really came to mind. It's just the really, how is this going to impact Canada soccer's reputation? How is it going to impact them financially in the short term? Because they still don't have the FIFA windfall money, which is going to transform the sport in this country by a long way. But for the next 4 to 5 months, they still have to make do with what they have generated. So that is really the top thing that is sort of top of mind right now.
You know, Peter, I understand that, again, the soccer part of this, I mostly understand. So they wanted, and again, I think the opponent that they hoped to get for this friendly was Tunisia. That makes sense because they're playing Morocco in the group stage. They wanted a team that played from the region, that played a similar style. I'm not sure why the Tunisia deal fell through, but it did. They were looking for a plan B, and there is a financial aspect to this. We know they're going to pay Iran $400,000, which in terms of getting a side, especially a World Cup side for a friendly, reason I guess is a bargain. But the risk reward, like, this is the part I don't get. From a soccer point of view, and Iran's a good, would have given Canada a real test and a different style and somebody outside the Confederation, all the things they wanted. So from a soccer point of view, yeah. But this isn't about soccer at this stage.
Right.
And that's where I don't understand why the alarm bell didn't go off and somebody in the Canadian Soccer Association say, understand that there was, the players expressed trepidation about this, the staff did. Mm-hmm. Why they didn't say, man, this is not going to work out. And even if it does work out, it's going to be messy, like really, really messy.
Yeah, that was a question I had as well. Because, if you have the option of no friendly or a friendly where you get all this backlash and just all the ramifications from it, you're going to take no friendly. And even though it might have some short-term detriments, in the long term, your reputation's still intact. You're not dealing with all this political fallout. You don't get any sort of reprimandation from FIFA because, of course, when the 2026 World Cup host cities are announced, and I believe it's actually 3 weeks today it's being announced, who knows what could happen with that, knowing that this just kind of threw a wrench into things. But, you know, it really does speak to, as much as the team on the pitch has made massive strides over the last 12 to 14 months, in terms of the management of the CSA, it is still not up to par. Some of that is due to the lack of resources compared to other federations. But when you're dealing with things that really just a little bit of common sense would be able to solve, it's when you kind of think to yourself, okay, were those John Herdman links to some English-based teams really all that far-fetched, knowing that, you know, if the Federation can't handle simple things like this, does John Herdman maybe take one step back and go, maybe it may not be the best idea to stay here until 2026. Maybe I might start evaluating my options elsewhere. So there's a lot of layers to it, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and especially when he's the first guy that has to talk publicly about it. Like, if he does the first media availability, I can't imagine what he's going to be thinking at this point. You're right to mention the windfall that is coming for them after they appear in the World Cup in November. But this was going to be a moneymaker as well, Peter, because, yeah, I mean, that's part of the reason why they decided on Iran. 400K sounds like a lot, not compared to some of the other nations that you would have had to, the number that you would have had to dole out to them to get them into this country to play a friendly. And that was supposed to be a sold-out BC place. Like, how important is it for them to try and exhaust every opportunity to make some money on June 5th?
Well, that was just it, and I'm just doing rough math here, but, you know, just based on the average ticket price for that game and the fact that it was going to be sold out in all likelihood, even if you take away the $400,000 that, let's say, it came out of purely from the ticket sales, Canada Soccer still would have made around $3 million from that game, and they've made about anywhere from $2 to $3 million, maybe even pushing $4 million through most of their home qualifiers in the last round of qualifying. So even though they were hit hard during the pandemic, they have slowly been reloading their coffers to the point where they've been able to charter the odd flight. They've had youth national team camps outside of tournament windows, which has never been the norm. So little things like this were starting to improve. Getting that money would have been major for them. And I mean, even further to that, yes, they would have had to travel to Honduras for that second Nations League game. They had Curaçao on the 9th and then Honduras on the 13th. The real question for me now, even just kind of thinking back in hindsight, the line that was trotted out was, the reason we only did one friendly is because of the travel restraints that are put on us. But when you look at a lot of the other CONCACAF nations, even, like, I believe Mexico has about four or five games in this window. And I know they're probably going to split up their squad a little bit, and the travel is maybe a little easier for them because they're mostly just playing in the U.S. But regardless, it kind of makes you wonder, why didn't Canada just have a first friendly, say, on June 2nd in Vancouver, and kind of have like a Vancouver series? And then that way, if one of the friendlies falls through, at least you have another friendly to lean on and go, all right, well, at least we still get one preparatory match against a quality opponent to test ourselves. And even looking ahead to how John Herdman's going to rotate the squad, I'm sure he was going to want to play his A team, his best possible team, against Iran, and then rotate for the Nations League games to give mostly the European-based guys a bit of a rest after what was a long, grueling season for them.
What's the possible explanation for that, Peter? That why they didn't have the tack on a second friendly?
The line they have been giving us is that it was just purely the travel implications, which, again, I can't understand why you couldn't have just had, again, a first friendly, say, on the Thursday, June the 2nd, or even the day before on June 1st, like some other CONCACAF teams have been doing. And it's not like you couldn't have even had a little bit of a camp leading up to that with just the European-based guys, because their seasons are over. They've been over for a few days. So they could have flown over, reacclimatized to the schedule, to the time zones, gotten their feet wet with the guys in the camp, and then the MLS guys eventually join, and then they just play from there. It does baffle me, but that seems to be the line they're giving.
Yeah, well, being baffled is there's a lot of that going around right now too. What are the implications if they can't schedule another friendly here? In terms of the implications in terms of World Cup preparation, obviously they were looking for, again, a test here and a specific kind of test. That may not happen. There is also the financial component. Not only are they not going to reap the benefits of this if they can't come up with something, but I assume they've paid the Iranians some of that money anyway, and it appears they're getting sued, but we'll see, for $10 million.
Right.
But in terms of the road to Qatar, I know, behind the scenes, there's a scramble to try and raise private money right now to support this team. They get some government money, and money's coming when they get there, but it's about the months of preparation. Like, what's the fallout from this potentially?
Well, just from the sporting side of it, because we discussed the financial side of it, it's going to be major, because now you're left dealing with only two games between that first or second week of June until the September window, when the team is earmarked to go to Europe to play what they hope to be marquee teams. But even then, you may get two, possibly three games. Then there's no October window to accommodate the Winter World Cup, which I still can't quite wrap my head around. And then you go right into the World Cup, because most of the European leagues are going to pause essentially the week before the opening match. So there's not going to be any even real pre-World Cup friendlies like we've been used to. Really, around this time is when they actually start to play, when they play the World Cup in the summer. So you don't even get, one or two games before that World Cup to really prepare. So you really just have that September window, four games at this point, plus those two Nations League games. And I'm sure it's just going to throw a wrench into all of John Herdman's plans, because he's a man, and you guys know this, that he meticulously plans things out with the sports science. How many minutes can we get out of this guy? Are we going to play him for 90 in this game, 60 in the next game? Like, it's just going to throw everything for a loop at this point. So it's going to be major, especially if they then can't really fulfill some promises that they were giving to the fans over the last couple of months, and that if they don't get a marquee nation in September, then you're really going to start to see a bit of an uproar here.
Yeah, but you're going to try and be even more frugal then, especially when you've got the sword of Damocles hanging over your head of maybe $10 million going to Iran. So you mentioned the June 16th announcement of the host cities for the 2026 World Cup. Is there any indication of how FIFA feels about this, and what the actual real-world implications of that announcement, of what's happened here, and it impacting that announcement in 3 weeks?
Well, based on what I was told about a week ago, maybe a little less than that, the thought within the CSA was FIFA understandably won't be too happy. And I find this so ironic, because they don't like it when political figures get involved, which is just hilarious. But I think with this happening, and whatever the reason was, whether the government canceled the Iranian visas, which were still in limbo, I believe as recently as yesterday, whether the CSA just, bowed to all the pressure from the government to cancel it, whatever the case, FIFA's probably not going to look too kindly on it. Before this happened, I would say that really the two favorites to get games would have been Vancouver and Toronto. Edmonton, the cost would have been too much to upgrade Commonwealth Stadium. The Alberta government was getting a little afraid about that. And then, not coincidentally, right around the same time, that's when the CSA and FIFA approached Vancouver and the province of BC to potentially enter the selection process and sort of shoulder that burden. So that would have been likely the plan. Now, I can't imagine it changes this late, but I mean, you never know. FIFA tends to always shock us in new and impressive ways.
I want to ask you about one other little element to this story, and that's young Mr. Coliocho who plays for Espanyol, right, or for their youth team, I guess. So he was named to Canada's squad. He was going to come to camp with Canada for this window, and he would have potentially played in the friendly. He can't play in the Nations League games because he would be cap tied.
Right.
But he has options to play for Canada, the United States. Is there more than that? There may be more.
I think there's Italy potentially.
Yeah.
Italy, Nigeria. Yep.
Now, you know, and again, one of the hallmarks of this John Herdman era, especially, has been this quest to get those guys, you know, get them and get them to play for Canada, the guys who have options. What, tell us about him as a player, Peter, and how, like, again, the significance of this falling apart, potentially that match not happening, and the, you know, the gong show element of the CSA. If you're trying to showcase the program, it's got to be a little bit of a setback, doesn't it?
100% it does. And this isn't the first time this has happened. Now, the last two times they have tried to bring in dual nationals and fairly marquee dual nationals into their camps, it was canceled because of COVID reasons. You had Marcelo Flores, the Arsenal youngster who recently committed to Mexico. He probably would have ended up committing to Mexico anyways, but it could have been nice to have him in the camp, at least say, hey, we tried. He prefers Mexico for X, Y, and Z reason, and that's just all there is to it. They also called up Stefan Mitrovic in January, just a few months ago. He's a 19-year-old winger slash forward who's been killing it in the Serbian Superliga for Radnički Niš. He has 10 goals, 3 assists. It's looking like he's going to join Tejan Buchanan at Club Bruges in Belgium. And I mean, he's just really broken out. Now, what's curious is Serbia is also apparently in heavy contact with him, as much as the Canadian senior side is. But he's not willing to really go one way or the other. Understandably so. He is young. It's a big decision. But he was actually called up for that January camp and was going to take part in the week leading up to what was going to be a Guatemala friendly before Omicron canceled that entire camp, leaving Canada with just the qualifiers. So he didn't end up coming in. Now you're dealing with what is self-inflicted damage with Cole Osho. He could still come in, train, and I'm sure he will still do that. There's no indication he won't. But you could have put him into a match, have him really get the feel for playing in front of a Canadian crowd. Yes, it might have been more pro-Iranian, but regardless, all those factors are now out the window, which is really disappointing in a Canadian soccer perspective, especially because, you know, you did, in a way, get one over on the U.S. by calling him up, you know, at this time, because he did have under 20 call-ups and whatnot, but never went into any of those camps. And, I mean, he's just a very dynamic winger, quite an exciting young player, has really broken through in the last year, really. And, you know, it's interesting, too, because Canada's loaded at the wing position, but they don't have as many quality options playing in what John Herdman calls Tier 1 leagues. And Cole Osho is obviously contracted to a team in a Tier 1 league. So it would have been nice to see. I'm sure he'll still come in and train, but it would have been much, much different, obviously, if he had played in what would have been a pretty entertaining as well as high-quality game as well.
Whoops. That's not going to happen.
Whoops.
Yeah, it's a big-time whoops on many different fronts. Peter, great job covering this, and thanks for doing this today.
Thanks, Peter.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
There's Peter Galindo, Sportsnet soccer writer. Man, what a, just a colossal mess. And it's just...
Self-inflicted.
And, you know, when things were going well and it did feel like Canada soccer was turning a corner... We heap praise on them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not just the John Herdmans, but the like Nick Bontis, everybody, because, yep. You know, whether they were directly responsible or whatever, it doesn't matter. If you're at the helm and things are good, you get the plaudits for that.
Yep.
But now, you know, I don't know the inner workings of this organization, and my history with this organization is not what yours is or Peter's or Craig Forrest is, but... You give people an opportunity to talk about what's actually going on in that organization right now, despite the success recently. And to a person, they say that there's still massive problems, and this would be a pretty good indication.
Well, and they're going to enter a phase of relative prosperity that they've never enjoyed before. Once the World Cup happens and they cash that FIFA check, and we know that Canada's in the next World Cup as one of the co-hosts, like this... This is the moment when this organization has to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, welcome to the big time. And like, I know they've had to scrape for every dollar over the years. They have, and you know, they're living off the government by and large. And you know, even heading into a World Cup right now, like I know John Herdman is knocking on doors, corporate doors, saying support our team. You know, sort of the way, you know, B210 supported Olympic athletes going back to 2010. you know, come in and help us because we don't have the resources. Like you heard Peter talking, you know, you're talking about whether you can charter a plane to fly guys places. Like that's still the conversation. And I guarantee you, you know, in Brazil or Spain, they're not having that conversation.
Yeah.
So we're now, but we're about to be part of that universe.
Yeah.
And the future is extraordinarily bright. And that's even without talking about the women's team, you know, who have, you know, done rather well for the last 10 years.
Yeah. Now what I'm thinking about is that this qualifying for the World Cup, the prosperity that this team is enjoying right now, it almost insulates the people at the top there. Like, despite this major foul-up, they can still say, hey, listen, we brought this program back to the World Cup for the first time since 1986. Mm-hmm. Like, are they protected, seemingly?
Well, once it blows over, but there, you know, we will be talking about the World Cup again pretty soon.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the problem that they're going to have is that the people who know the most about it and who are the strongest critics of it are the people on the inside,
mm-hmm.
right? This is kind of blown up for the public now, the general public and even the casual public, not the soccer, like the hardcore soccer community in this country, they know. Mm-hmm. Like this isn't new. Mm-hmm. It's just there are different people there now, but this isn't a new problem. But, you know, we're in a different world for soccer and men's soccer in this country right now. People do notice and they know who Alphonso Davies is and they know there's a World Cup and they know who John Herdman is. Yeah. And so you can't just, you know, sweep this one under the rug and hope it goes away. It's not going away.
No. John Herdman might be going away, honestly.
Like, if they blow that.
And maybe it won't be positioned as they blew it because he'll go, you know, to a championship side or, you know, a bigger national program or something. But, yeah, I think it's not all just taking a better job, it feels like. And if it were up to me, if anyone was asking for my advice, and nobody is, but I might just hand the keys over to him if he wants them and said, you know, you have free reign to do whatever you want with this organization. It is yours top to bottom.
If I was him and somebody, one of these guys said that to me, I would say, here's how we're going to define this. And here are the resources we need to be successful. And can you deliver that? And I have a lot of questions. And I would have a whole lot of questions. And every coach of every Canadian national team, men's or women's, over the many, many years has asked those questions.
Yeah.
Some of those coaches were great. Some of them were lousy. But they all asked the same questions. Like, this is a particular moment and a particular screw-up. But that is those questions have been asked internally for a long, long time.
I liked it better when we talked about this program, you know, and the exciting players.
That's still there, right? It's still there. And I know somebody, and look, I also know somebody, I'm sure somebody in the federal government,
yeah,
you know, is also partially responsible
100%.
For this, and now are looking, or they're seeking cover. I know it's not just the CSA here, but, you know, it's not like the government suggested.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, why don't you guys play Iran? That'd be an idea. I think this was their initiative.
Well, do you think whoever that government employee is, that politician is, do you think they'll step forward and say, you know what?
I think it's highly unlikely, Ben.
Anyways, that was, again, the top story brought to you by Thornhill Toyota. By the way, we do have a Blue Jays lineup, and Kevin Biggio is in the lineup.
Uh-huh. At what position?
First base. Uh-huh. He's batting ninth. Vlad's in the lineup as the DH. Absent from the lineup today, Teoscar Hernandez. So he gets a day off. Lourdes Gurriel Jr. back in there. Danny Jansen doing the catching, of course, with Hyunjin Ryu on the mound. Matt Chapman moving up. He's hitting fifth today behind Bo Bichette. Anyways, we will be back tomorrow. This has been the Fan Drive Time. Ben Annis, Stephen Brunt, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.